Hey guys, if you know me, you know I love to travel and you know I love to save money. This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. From choosing the right travel card to dodging hidden fees, Smart Travel helps your money go further. Literally. They cover all things travel finance, like how to plan group trips that don't bust your budget or your friendships. How to maximize points for real savings, not just free bottled water. How to avoid paying for upgrades you won't use, and so much more. They're doing great work over there. Check it out. Travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
Welcome to the Travel Tales Podcast.
The winners are the people with the most stories.
One of the great things about traveling is the people that you meet.
I've slept in bus stations, I've slept on people's floors.
And it's already on fire, and then there's just a gigantic, huge explosion, like out of a Hollywood movie.
It's not right or wrong, it's just different.
We hired 10 Chinese prostitutes to come be our audience.
We were kidnapped by nuns in Puerto Rico.
Not a good idea to be high when you're packing. You forget a lot of stuff.
I got swine flu.
By the time you've lived through it, it's just a good story.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Travel Tales Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Siegel. Thanks for listening. My guest today is Ollie France. And before we get to Ollie, here's a few announcements. Our website is traveltalespodcast.com. Go there and you'll find some stories that I've written, some stories some of the guests have written. You'll find links to their social media. You'll find links to our social media. And that is, of course, the big one, Travel Tales Podcast on Instagram. Go there, follow us, subscribe, do what you got to do. Let's get those numbers up, shall we? And we have a Facebook page as well. You can find us there, Travel Tales Podcast. If you listen to us on a streaming device, as most of you do, be it Apple Podcasts or iHeartRadio or Spotify, wherever, please give us a good rating because that helps people find the show by boosting our presence. And that's a cool thing for you to do. And it costs you nothing. I've never asked you for money because I'm a bad businessman, but I'm asking you to at least do that because it takes no time. Subscribe, give us a good star rating, maybe say how awesome I am. And speaking of telling me how awesome I am, you can write me at traveltalespodcast@gmail.com. That's traveltalespodcast@gmail.com. I'm going to paint the picture right now. We're in my cabin of a Cunard Queen Elizabeth. So yeah, that's the great acoustics in here. I got to admit, I've done a lot of recording in cabins, and it's some of the best acoustics that you're going to find. No echo, carpet, wonderful. Anyway, I was on the ship and I noticed there was a speech by an adventurer. And I said, well, this is right up my alley. And I went and watched Ollie France on the stage give a speech earlier in the week about his trip from Death Valley to Denali up in Alaska and climbing the peak. So the lowest to highest in elevation on the North American continent. And it was a fascinating story. And he had a second speech this morning on the ship, and I was ready to go, pumped, couldn't wait to see what it was about, and realized when I got there, something was off, and I realized this was the day last night that they moved the clocks ahead an hour. And of course, we're all on airplane mode here on my phones, and I had no idea. Walked in, he was done. So we're going to talk about that now. And let me just say, thank you for coming. And I apologize for being an idiot this morning.
Hey, Mike, it is awesome to be here. Thank you very much. And no worries at all. I'm almost mixed breakfast, but fortunately, I got the time right before my talk, which was far more important than breakfast.
Okay, so I wasn't alone there. Yeah. Thank God. As you can tell by Ollie's accent, he's from Alabama. What part of England are you from?
I am from Manchester, Northern England.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to ask, red or blue?
Red.
Okay. Red. Sorry, this is around this time of the last few years. Tell me about, we're going to start with the Death Valley to Denali, and this is an incredible story. First of all, how long did it take to do? Why did you want to do this? And this is only the beginning, is it not?
It is. It is only the beginning. And so this was a 10-year dream. So when you ask how long it took, 10 years essentially, to bring this project to fruition, I was thinking about it for years and years. And I'd grown up with a map on my wall. I'm a lover of geography. I would read about countries, mountain ranges, lakes, rivers, capitals, everything. And this idea gradually formed of, all right, I want to go and climb Denali. Alaska for me is kind of the pinnacle of adventure, big mountains, total wilderness, but how can I make it more unique? And I studied the geography and I thought, Death Valley, you know, yeah, there you've got a total opposite climate. You've got a desert. It's this Martian landscape. It's the hottest point. It's the lowest point in the continent. So I had a look at tying these two together as this human-powered journey, which would involve 3,500 miles of cycling, would involve skiing up to the summit of Denali almost, and then climbing the final bit to stand on the very peak. So it took years of thinking about this thing, and then eventually in 2023 I committed to it. I then built a team around it. I then managed to get sponsors on board after much hard work and rejection, and then ultimately set off in March 2024 for what was a 64-day journey right across the whole continent.
That's amazing. So if I'm a sponsor, a potential sponsor, I want to know your background and why am I giving this guy money and will he make it? So what kind of background did you have that sold these people that you could actually, A, finish it and you weren't some kind of shyster?
Yes, good point. You know, getting money for nothing is going to be very hard, particularly when you're speaking to big corporates with lots of decision makers, etc. So my background, I studied outdoor leadership at university, which is a real degree, believe it or not. I've got the certificate, can prove it. So that was 3 great years learning from top level instructors. I'm surrounded now by people who love adventure. I'm being encouraged and go off in my summers to work in the US, in the Middle East, in Africa, in Australia. And so this love is forming. I then had a bit of a change. I got back to the UK after 4 years, checked the bank balance and thought, okay, maybe time to get a proper job, as everyone's been telling me. Spent 2 years in the corporate world selling kitchens, strangely enough. I didn't have much luck there. In fact, I didn't sell a single kitchen in 12 months, other than the one I sold to myself. I got a good deal on that one. And that was 2015, and I quit that job. You know, the writing was on the wall, quite frankly. And I've spent the last 10 years taking on big solo expeditions around the world and then getting into guiding teams through remote and hostile places, places like Iraq and Syria, Somalia, Yemen, Congo, Siberia, and gradually over time building my skills, building my networks, until I had something at least of substance to take to these corporates and try and get them to sponsor me.
So you were building up your resume by, were you going as a guest, not as a tour guide, or you were just signing up? Like, would you go online and find these expeditions and say, I want to join? And did you have to pay to join? Or
so first time, yes. I did a mountain climb in Morocco at the age of 19, and I managed to get some funding from my university. They had this travel bursary program and you could apply. And I was the only student across 30,000 or so in the uni who got this 3 years running, because I spent more time trying to figure out how to get this bursary than I did on my actual degree. And so first year I went over to Morocco. I had a bit of cash, so I booked myself onto a trek. It was 2 weeks through the Atlas Mountains, very remote, climbing big snowy mountains. And that was kind of the foundation. I thought, yeah, I love this. But for me, the next step was always going to be trying to go off solo. And I think that when you're on your own, that accelerates your learning in a way, because you're then responsible for making all the decisions, for thinking about risk, for managing yourself, getting from A to B, and facing any number of challenges that you might face. So most of my travels have been either solo or with small teams. Sometimes I've had kind of mentors and I'm picking up skills off them. I've gone and done a number of training courses in the mountains and got qualified. I did my degree. And then much of it has been me actually then guiding teams in overseas locations.
So you did most of this in the last 10 years, it sounds like. And this is the age of social media. Did you decide that, okay, I'm going to build this kick-ass blog about it, or I'm going to put it all on Instagram? And how did you approach that? Or was it more of a private thing?
It was very reluctant, actually. And I went off. I quit the day job. And my first big thing was going to do a trip from Hong Kong to Istanbul, all the way across Asia. So 11 countries in the middle of winter on my own, climbing mountains in every country. And honestly, I just had this burning need to do this thing. I wasn't even on Instagram. I wasn't on Facebook. But everyone's telling me, look, people want to read about this. People want to see this. So very reluctantly, I set up an account. I started to share some stories, you know, diary entries almost. People seem to enjoy it. And so, whenever I'm doing expeditions now, I do try and share. I don't think it comes that naturally to me, but it's nice. I think there are a lot of armchair adventure lovers out there, people who want to be taken on adventure from the comfort of their homes, or sometimes they like doing it themselves. But I do enjoy that interaction and sharing the story.
Does it take a little something away from it because you're out there trying to survive, really? And then the last thing on your mind should be, well, I got to shoot this. I got to get some video. I got to post. I mean, there have been moments where I'm like, what am I doing here? I'm hungry. I shouldn't be shooting a video. But how do you balance it?
That's so true. And, you know, at the end of a 12-hour day, the last thing you want to do is sit down and edit some video and write some long caption. So what I would do is, at first I did that and I thought it's too much. It's not doable. So what I would do is, say if I'm on a long solo ride or a long hike, you know, I'll record a voice note or something. These days it's super easy. You record a voice note, that becomes your caption. I can do that just where my mind is running. And then just keep it super simple, you know, really simple video, couple of images. And so, you know, it's nice to share that story, but you're right. If you're spending too much time thinking about sharing it, you're not really living in the moment. I think photographers have the same problem, actually. So, you know, incredible photographers out there taking big pictures of landscapes and things, but there's always a balance, you know, are they really experiencing it if they're living life behind the lens? So I try and find that and navigate the balance.
Yeah, it always seems to me like it's a tough thing that at least I'm not, and maybe this is why I'm not a super popular travel blogger in terms of, like, I've seen how those, I call them kids because I've done media trips with them. They're constantly posting every day and they always have to have a connection. You know, they flip out if they're away from Wi-Fi too long. And I just decided I didn't want to live that way. You know, I'll take the photos, I'll take the video, and then I prefer to like put it together when I get home. Like, I don't want to take myself out of it while I'm there. You must have amassed a ton of video and photos. Is there what was the thought of a film or anything? Somebody following you on these adventures? Have you thought of that?
Yes, I have. So you're right. I've got, you know, hard drives upon hard drives full of images, which are, you know, quite sacred. I do have them backed up. But yeah, I've got tons of footage out there, tons of images. And so right now with this project, so Death Valley to Denali was just one stage of seven. So my ultimate aim is to do the same project in all seven continents. And I've been... I've actually built this 5-year relationship with quite a large production company in the UK. You know, 5 years of them getting to know me, me getting to know them. And so we are now working together and they are starting to produce short films on YouTube for now and on socials. Hopefully somewhere down the line with all of this footage, you know, we can get it out there into the wider world. So we're working on it. But yeah, I think the foundation is there, I hope.
Well, I watched, at least from Death Valley to Denali, and my whole thought, and I know you must have get this all the time, is you're going from the lowest point to the highest, and you got to end with the hardest part, which is climbing a mountain, the most dangerous part. And my thought was, why don't you start at the highest and go down? I mean, that seems, yeah, going downhill just seems so much easier. I mean, is it just because of that it's harder going up?
Yes. Somebody asked me that question this morning and they said, you know, how was it starting in Death Valley? The single hardest part is you're in the lowest point in the continent. There's only one way out of there, which is up. And I had this 4,000-meter unbearably hot climb straight out of Death Valley, you know, and at the end of day one, you're thinking, what have I signed up to here? So I think that would have been a much more enjoyable journey. But, you know, historically, you've got to go up the mountain. You know?
But I had no idea how dangerous Denali was. And I haven't met too many people that have climbed it. And I guess it is very rare. Is it because of the conditions? I mean, how does it compare to, say, I don't know. I did Kilimanjaro. That's the only thing I can relate it to, which was just pretty much a trail going up. I mean, you're going over crevasses and there's ropes and, you know, things involved. On a scale of 1 to Everest, where does Denali fit in?
Denali is right up there, really. And People often say, I've not climbed Everest, but I know people who've climbed both Everest and Denali. Some say Denali is harder. There are a few reasons for that. It is colder and windier, generally, than Everest. Because it's so far north, it's up in Alaska, it's near the Arctic Circle. Also, there are no porters or Sherpas, so nobody's helping with your gear. You've got to do this weird thing, which you see on no other mountain, where you've got a sled with 60 pounds of gear. You've then got a pack with about 50 pounds of gear, and you're on your own with that. And you've got to take that, you know, all the way up the mountain, at least to the high camp. So moving on the mountain is very, very hard. The mountain is punishing. There's nowhere to hide. You take your gloves off for a minute, you're going to get frostbite at high elevations. By the time you're on the summit, there is no, you know, nobody's taking oxygen up there. So the oxygen level is similar to Killy, probably. You know, by the summit day, you absolutely feel it. You'll know what it's like. And your pace is a few hundred meters an hour. So it's brutally hard, and for that reason you only get a few hundred people attempting to climb, and usually the success rate is about 30 or 40%. So, and these are all very experienced vetted climbers who, you know, the park rangers have approved. So always one of the doubts for me was, I could get so far into this, I could do the ride, I could do the hard approach to Denali, and then ultimately you're on this dangerous mountain with so much uncertainty, are we going to make it?
Yeah. And Denali has bears.
And Denali has bears, as we found, yeah, on the southern slopes. So most people skip that bit, fly into the base camp. We were doing this human-powered approach, which meant 8 days bushwhacking, crossing rivers, crossing crevasses. We woke up to huge grizzly prints 20 meters from our tent. Pretty terrifying. Nearby, we found why the grizzly was there, which was a huge moose carcass, and we got some pictures. But yeah, that was pretty scary, I've got to admit.
And you get a time out, the right time of year to do this. So when did you start the journey, and when did it end?
So yes, and getting there in the right season is critically important. So we got to the start of the mountain early May, and that's kind of right at the start of the climbing season. The reason we had to go early was there's more snow cover on the lower slopes for our approach, so we could ski. A month later, we wouldn't have been able to access the mountain on skis. So that means that early in the season, it's a lot colder. But generally, the weather is a bit more stable. Later in the summer, you get a lot more snow, you get higher temperatures, which can increase the avalanche risk, which means all the crevasses open up. It's still doable, but it gets a bit more complex. So in a way, the colder, more stable temperatures are favorable. So that's what we went for. We finished up right at the end of May, and then managed to get out of there just at the start of June.
And I saw you were on cross-country skis as well. And this is going to sound like a dumb question, but are cross-country skis better than, say, snowshoes, and why?
Yes. So this was a big debate we had as a team, actually, because most people climbing Denali do use snowshoes, actually. So we had that debate of, do we use snowshoes or do we use skis? Skis also come with a lot more stuff. You need proper ski boots, you need the skis, you need the skins, you need the repair kits. Snowshoes, you just stick them on any boot, super lightweight. So that was a debate for us. But what we decided was, we could cover ground quite a lot faster with skis. You can sort of move along more efficiently. They're a bit less cumbersome. And in deep, really deep, soft snow, even snowshoes can be hard, you know, pretty hard going, where with skis, you can float across the surface. So that's what we decided to do. I think it worked out for the best. We were typically, once we got on the mountain proper, we were overtaking those teams with snowshoes. But the real challenge comes when you start going downhill, actually, because now you've still got this sled attached to you, and you know, anyone with an understanding of gravity, as soon as you start going downhill on these skis, the sled takes over you, and that thing weighs 50-60 pounds still. It spins you, you know, like a big pendulum. You fall on the ground, you get yourself back up. So in the end, what we had to do was almost have it like a dog on a tether, just right by your side here, and it's like a wild dog, you know, and you're trying to ski with it downhill, off-piste, you know, with a heavy rucksack. So it's not, when I sold this to my friends as a ski trip to Alaska, it's definitely not what they had in mind.
Exactly. So from the time you get, do you start at the base? I mean, in Kilimanjaro, we started halfway up, you know, 8,000 feet or whatever. Where do you start at Denali, and how long did it take you to peak?
Well, with the way we did it, we started not too far above sea level. So we're just probably 1,000 feet above sea level. So really low. I think if you start at the base camp, so most teams are flying in via ski plane, that's around 4,500. So you still got a big leap up to the summit, which is above 20,000 feet. It's a long approach. It's a long climb. And actually, Denali is interesting because it's got the highest relief of any mountain in the world. So it's the highest point above the surrounding landscapes. You've just got sea level and sort of coastal plains around it. And then suddenly you've got this mountain which rises to 20,000 feet. If you're in the Himalayas, you know, climbing Everest, you're going to be starting up at 3,000-4,000 meters already. So, it's a beast. It's an absolute beast, and it's pretty intimidating. When we got our first view of this mountain, this thing just loomed over us. It seemed, how on earth are we going to get up there?
Yeah. Let's talk about the ride up. So, what was the longest you traveled in one day of biking? And I was wondering, while you were showing some video, you were on kind of, I don't know, two-lane kind of country roads, but did you ever be on the, I don't think you're allowed on the interstate, are you? Or were there big trucks going by you? And this seems as dangerous as climbing.
It was definitely as dangerous as climbing. And it was really terrifying because actually in some states, which really surprised me, you are allowed on the interstates. Lot quicker and more direct, but very, very scary. You did get a slight benefit because you've got all these trucks going past, it sort of breaks up the air, so it feels a bit easier. But still, I got a lot of funny looks from, you know, local truckers who were flying past me. Other than that, mostly I was on quieter roads. When I got up to the, you know, up onto the Alaska Highway, which is the big road that connects Canada up to Alaska, it was this major engineering feat. Now you're in really isolated areas. And so that means my big thing is, how can I get food and fuel and water, and how much do I need to take until I can find it again? And sometimes you've got gaps of 300 miles between towns. You know, it's unbelievably remote. I think going into this as a non-North American, you think, well, it's very built up. You know, there's going to be towns everywhere. There's going to be stores everywhere. But no, I mean, it's true wilderness up there. Once you're in British Columbia, Yukon, Alaska, proper wilderness. So the longest, I had this big day. I did about 150 miles in one day. And I had to do that push because, one, there was nothing. There was no amenities in between. And two, it was bear country, and I was really not fancying camping in that area. So I was desperate to get to the next town. So I did a big, big day. But yeah, 150 miles on a bike in a day, which, you know, heavy loaded bike, was tough going.
Oof, man. And so you were camping most of the time. Did you ever say, ah, to hell with it, I'm getting a hotel room?
Yes, I did.
I'm
not ashamed to admit it. So sometimes in those more remote areas where you're going through blizzards, all of your gear is getting wet, you're getting soaked, you're limited on food, and now you're going through bear areas. Yeah, I'm not ashamed to admit it. Sometimes I had to go and find a motel. I had to dry my gear. I had to have a shower. I had to have a good meal and get myself ready for the next part.
Did the locals ever, you know, pull up alongside you and say, what the hell are you doing out here? Or did they warn you, don't carry on that way or anything?
Yes, that happened. So, you know, I had people pulling over, asking him if I'm okay. Usually I think the intentions are really good and they want to help you out. And I had people giving me drinks, giving me food. I did have people questioning my sanity.
Yeah.
That happened. I had people asking me if I was prepared for bears, which I was to some degree, but you can only be so prepared on your own on a bike. Actually, a lot of people were warning me more about the moose, which is something I hadn't realized. And I would speak to locals and say, you know, have you seen any bears locally? Have there been any sightings? And they'd say, yeah. And I got nervous. But then they'd say, yeah, but you want to be more worried about the moose because they can be very territorial, huge antlers, which hadn't even occurred to me. So now I had this new fear to worry about.
Be careful of the bald eagles swooping down. Yeah, moose are gigantic. Until you see one in person, you have no idea how huge those things are. They're really big. But, that was amazing. How low did you ever get on food? And was there a moment there like, man, I'm really feeling weak and I got to get something soon?
Yes, there was. One very unenjoyable day way up in, I think that was southern Yukon, and I had this 130 mile stretch to cover, but it was a really hard 130 mile stretch. Lots of mountain passes up and down. The weather was bad, but about 80 miles in on my map, I'd spotted this little gas station. I thought, great, you know, I'll just do 80 miles. It'll be really hard. I can stock up on food, and then I'll go and do another 50 to get to the next town, because this is prime grizzly country now. And so I get there, and I'm pretty much depleted on food and water and absolutely cooked. You know, it's been such a huge day, and I get roll up. I see this gas station in the distance, and I get there and it's all boarded up.
Oh,
and there's nothing. And so I just had, you know, the few little snacks left, and I had to get back on the bike exhausted, do another 50 miles. And I can tell you, being on complete empty like that is just not fun in any way.
Did you have, as most like extreme mountain climbers do, and so did you travel with like emergency GPS and all these other things that you can call? And
yes, definitely. So this was a lesson I learned, you know, years ago when I was caught out in, that was in Morocco actually, on another trip, and I was in the mountains there. I planned this big expedition. It was a solo one. I was young. I was full of bravado. I thought everything will be fine. I can do anything. Turns out, you know, I was very unprepared. Right. And so I learned that lesson. So on this one, I have a series of things. We had satellite tracking devices. So these, they're called Garmin InReaches, and these are amazing pieces of kit. They track you. People back home can track you live. And also it's a way of you communicating with the outside world. So you can send messages. You can also raise a SOS beacon wherever you are in the world. And we also had satellite phones if we needed them.
No, that's good. I mean, boy, they used to do it back in the day with nothing, none of that. So, give me your, the lessons learned, and then we'll move on to your other trips. What was different about it that you thought, what surprised you the most that you weren't expecting, in both good and bad? What was the, wow, this is really amazing, and other days were like, oof, I didn't really think it was going to be like this. What was the, what were the highs and lows compared to your expectations?
I think that they're both linked to the landscapes in North America. One, you know, just the sheer scale of this continent, because having spent 6 weeks cycling across it and then another month climbing in Alaska, you know, cycling 3,500 miles, you really begin to appreciate just the true scale of everything. The mountains, the rivers, the distances, the deserts, you know, everything is, you even get these roads, which I'm sure you've driven on, where it's just pinned straight for, you know, 100 miles sometimes. On a bike, that's very demoralizing. Right. And so on a good day, it takes your breath away, and you're cycling beside these mountains, and there's huge animals everywhere, and it's just total wilderness. But on a bad day, that can be very intimidating, a very scary and lonely place to be, and you're a long way from civilization, and you're stuck in your own head, and the weather can be brutal, and you can get strong winds and blizzards. So it depends on the day you get. But the landscapes are both incredible and also can be quite intimidating.
How was your, what was your big meal after you finally finished, and how good did that shower feel?
Well, probably the first thing we need to do as a team is apologize to everyone else in the restaurant, because we got off the mountain after 22 days on there stinking, you know, and went straight into this bar and restaurant, ordered, oh, what did we order? We ordered a big chicken, like chicken wings. Yeah. Then we had a big pizza, yeah, right. You know, triple ice cream, beers. But we must have been absolutely stinking in this place. But it was the best meal we'd ever had. The big debate is always, when you're getting off a mountain, what's going to come first, shower, food, or beer? For us, it was food and beer, and the shower, the shower had to wait, but it felt good.
I respect the decision. I respect the decision. So that was last year, you said?
Yes, 2024, that one.
Wow, okay. And so let's move on to the other one you've completed, which is in Africa. And I know that Tanzania is the highest point on that continent, but what is the lowest and how far away is it? And I, for some reason, I assume it's in the Sahara, but it probably isn't. Or is it? I don't know. It's some rift valley? Where is it?
Yeah, so it's sort of on the Rift Valley. So it's out towards the Red Sea. So it's not far off. It's in Djibouti, which is a little African country on the Red Sea. And so that journey would take me to down through Ethiopia, all the way across it, all the way across Kenya, and then into northern Tanzania for the mountain. And Africa is a continent I'd spent a lot of time traveling there. I probably spent over a year of my life in Africa. I know it quite well. I've done multiple trips to Ethiopia before then. Ethiopia in particular is a tricky one because it's very, very tribal. I know people who've had problems there from tribal hostility. And I myself, unfortunately, every time I've been to Ethiopia, we've had pretty serious problems. So what I did was in Ethiopia, I actually hired some security to support me on that journey, which I was glad I did because throughout the, I did have people throwing rocks at me and even had people throwing knives at me and surrounding me. And
knives?
Yeah, I did. Oh. I did. So I was glad for that. But it, and then I got into Kenya and now I've got sort of wild animals on my mind. You're cycling through the Maasai area, the Maasai Mara. You've got lions and elephants and all kinds of things to worry about. Fortunately, I didn't see lions, but you know, those are a couple of the challenges. But it was incredible. You know, again, you go through every climate from this baking hot desert in the north in Djibouti through to hilly kind of jungle clad hills. You've got cycling around volcanoes in Kenya, which, you know, hardly anybody's going to see. You're going through safari areas, which to do it on two wheels is pretty cool. And then of course finishing up with Kilimanjaro, which is a mountain I absolutely love. I have been up there before, so it was familiar ground. I've got great friends there, and I can't recommend Kilimanjaro enough. It is an incredible mountain.
Now, you were with three other guys in Denali. Were you with other people on Kilimanjaro?
Yes. So what I did, I actually run trips to Kilimanjaro each year. So I'm back there in a few weeks. Oh. And so I had a small group of people with me, sort of as I was guiding on Kilimanjaro in a way. But I always work with the same people, same local guides and porters. And so they're amazing. You know, they're like, we're a great team on the mountain. And so it felt like familiar territory. But on a mountain, it's never guaranteed until you get up to that summit.
More people die up there than you hear about. And I found that out when I was there. Yeah. They're actually bringing, some guy died while we were there, and they were bringing a body back. I think a Korean guy had, he was done. But you always hear about the people dying on Everest, but you don't really hear about the people in Kilimanjaro. But was there a moment getting to there, and you said you had to hire people in Ethiopia, any run-ins with police or border agents or any bribes passed? You can admit it here.
This is not uncommon. A lot of these border posts, as I've been traveling around, particularly more unusual places, it's quite common at borders to have problems in one way or another, whether it's attempted extortion or, you know, so-called problems with your paperwork that needs cash to be smoothed over. So crossing into Ethiopia, the weird one that happened, and this was leaving Ethiopia to go into Kenya in a quite remote area. You've got the Kenyan desert to the south. You've got kind of Ethiopian tribal country to the north. I'm crossing the border and I had this guy approach me at the border. I'd just been stamped out of Ethiopia and he came up to me and he's being very serious and very, you know, very urgent. And he's saying, come with me, you need to come into my office. This is very serious. And I'm asking him, you know, what are you talking about? And he said, look, you've not paid the tax for your vehicle. You need to come with me right now. And I'm looking around thinking, you know, what vehicle? And he said, this vehicle here, which was my bike. and I just turned to him and said, look, that's my bike, you know. But fortunately for me, I knew my place in the world. I think that's through having a lot of these interactions over the years. I realized, having been stamped out of Ethiopia, there's absolutely nothing he can do. He was just chancing it. You know, he was trying it on. I'm no longer in Ethiopia. I'm in, you know, what's known as no man's land. And so I just ignored him for as long as possible, got stamped into Kenya, and then off I went. But yeah, I needed to handle that one delicately. And I think it would have been very easy to fall for his tricks and end up paying a bribe in his office.
Right. Well, it's a lot easier for you to blend in British Columbia than it is in Africa. Yeah. So you, there's no way you can't stand out. I mean, were kids and stuff swarming you, fascinated about, what, who is this guy? What are you doing?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, every time I stopped in Ethiopia and Kenya, I had just people. And even if you stop to go for a pee, you know, in the bushes, yeah. people are you're going to get swarmed. So you're going to be very fast. But yeah, it's fascinating. And I think it's just interest, because some of these parts of the world, they're not on the tourist trail. You know, nobody's going there. It's completely off the beaten track. They might see, you know, a couple of tourists each year. So it's, and it's nice. What I found is you don't always need to speak the same language to sort of communicate. And you can express, you know, that you're having a good day, or that you like it here, or that you, or, you know, they might offer you food sometimes, which is really cool. But yeah, they're some of my favorite interactions, just those random encounters.
Well, let's talk about the food part. I mean, it's not like you gas stations here that have a whole bunch of food ready for you to grab. You're probably in some really rural, poor areas. Did you ever run low of food there, and what happened?
Yeah, so my diet was pretty basic, I've got to say, in Africa. Partly I'm being a bit careful, because when I was previously in Ethiopia, I got really bad food poisoning. I was wiped out. In fact, a couple of days after that, I was in Somalia and I got meningitis and spent a week in hospital. So that had put me a bit on edge about what I'm eating in Somalia. Yeah. Oh. Well, luckily I got back to the UK. I just left Somalia. By the time I got home, I was seriously ill and ended up in hospital. Oh. So I got very lucky that I'd made it home. But this time I was a lot more careful. So I was just eating pretty basic food, rice and pasta and beans and lots of fruit. I mean, that's one great thing. You get incredible avocados, incredible mangoes and bananas and things, lots of that. But it did mean by the end of that trip, you know, I'd lost so much weight because it's scorching hot. I'm doing big days on the bike and I'm just not getting enough food. So it wasn't sustainable for months, but just for a couple of weeks, it was just about manageable.
What is meningitis technically, and how does it affect your body, and how is it different from average food poisoning?
Meningitis is a really, really nasty illness. And I think the fatality rate is something like 1 in 6. So it's really serious, and it can come on in different ways. Sometimes people might notice a rash, which doesn't go away. Sort of if you press it, the red spots stay. That's one of the classic signs. For me, it was this headache, which I've later learned is quite common. And so it was this headache, which I just could not get rid of. I was taking painkillers and then stronger painkillers. And this thing was intensifying to such a point that it literally felt like my brain was swollen and trying to explode out of my skull. It was the most excruciating pain I've ever experienced. If somebody would have offered to drill a hole in my head and relieve the pressure, I would have said yes in an instant. It was that bad. So yeah, I got lucky that I was in the UK and that they diagnosed it. If it's not diagnosed quickly, it can be a lot more serious. But yeah, that was a pretty wild experience. That was 2019, week in hospital. That was just before, and I was in isolation as well, before isolation was, you know, a thing.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Yeah. Man, good. Thank God you got out of that. Yeah. But so you're going through Africa. By the time you get to the mountain, and well, how long did it take you up the mountain? Because I was on the shortest route. Mine was like, I did the one with the huts, so it was like 5 days. Yeah, I know. I found that out later.
Yeah.
When I think I got a little bit of altitude sickness. Did you do one of the more established routes? And I guess you're a camper, so I'm sure you were camping, right?
Yeah, we were camping. We did the Machame route. Right. So we probably would have met your route somewhere near the summit, because all the routes eventually converge.
Right.
But that was a 7 days, 7 day trek. Camping, it's got a pretty good elevation profile, so you get quite high after 2.5 days, then you drop back down to about 12,000 feet, 4,000 meters, stay there for a couple of days and then go up. So it's pretty good for acclimatizing, but yeah, camping all the way. You know, what's special for me about Kilimanjaro is you start in the rainforest, you've got monkeys swinging the trees, and by the time you finish, you're in this loonscape with glaciers. So there can't be many treks in the world that are like that. That's why it's so special for me.
Yeah. No, I describe it to people, and that was that you saw the, you'd start within the jungle with, you know, like you said, monkeys and things, and then all of a sudden the trees start getting a little shorter, and then they get a little shorter, and then it's just shrubbery, and then there's just rock. And then finally snow. And it's, yeah, that's pretty amazing. Speaking of that, you've been there more than I have. I was 2014 when I was there. How were the snows? Because they said they were getting less and less up on the mountain. So what's the state of it now?
Yeah, so I've climbed Killy 5 times now. I'm going back for the 6th. So it's interesting because I'm now starting to see it year in, year out, and seeing how things are developing. And it depends, I guess. So on the whole, the glaciers are shrinking. That's a definite fact. I watched this. There's this North American climber, possibly Canadian, and he did this documentary, and he went ice climbing on the glaciers, which I don't think anybody had done before. He went ice climbing on glaciers 10 years ago. He went back 10 years later. Everything he'd ice climbed on, and he had images, was all gone. And so, it is shrinking. It's not. It's hardly surprising because it's near the equator. It's scorching hot. It's under the sun all year. But what I found on the summit days, we've had days where it's glorious sunshine and the clouds are the clouds are low and it's incredible. We've had days where it's freezing blizzard conditions and people have got these white frosted beards and things. And so it depends. The mountain can throw anything at you, but for sure some of the coldest temperatures I've experienced have been up there on Killy, which always surprises people. Right. Just how cold it gets. You're there in the equator.
Yeah. So speaking of altitude sickness, did you ever suffer from that? Or are you one of those people that are just like prone? I always tell people that's the big thing because it hits everybody differently. A 75-year-old woman would be fine and then a young Navy SEAL will be wiped out. Navy SEAL. So has it ever hit you and have you suffered from it?
Yeah, I have. So first time I climbed Killy, I felt awful on the summit day. But it was strange because I was also looking after this group. So I had to just really try and keep it to myself and try and stay composed. Meanwhile, feeling absolutely awful, terrible headaches, feeling nauseous. And I don't know why exactly, but since then I seem to have been okay. I've not had any major problems. I think maybe I've just figured out how to adapt a bit better to that kind of environment. I'm doing it more regularly, so maybe I keep some of those red blood cells. But yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to the altitude, it's just doing the basics well, hydrating well, eating well, sleeping well, taking your time, not walking too quickly. You do those things, you're going to be helping yourself. But it's so strange. And you're absolutely right. You can have the fittest person in the world, and I've seen that myself, and they can really suffer. I've had 60-odd-year-old people who've never climbed a mountain before, and they've had no issues whatsoever. Yeah. So it's really weird. I understand there's only two types of people who are scientifically proven to do better at altitude. One of them is asthma sufferers, and one of them is smokers. The theory is because they're used to having less lung capacity, groups. Not that I'm advocating, either of those, but... If you're in those categories, you might do better at altitude.
Well, the young Russian smokers I saw walking up that hill did not fare well. So we'll put that to the test. The distance. So in terms of miles, for my dumb American listeners like myself who still work in miles.
Me too.
Okay, good. What was about the distance total from Death Valley to Denali and then from the lowest point in Djibouti to Kilimanjaro? Were they similar, like 1,000 miles, or how long was it?
So North America was 3,500. Oh. So to put that in context, which, it's the same distance as Washington, D.C. to London. So it's like going across the entire equator. Not equator, the Atlantic. The distance in Africa was 1,600 miles. So it was significantly shorter. But that said, if you look at it on a map, it's only quite a small part of Africa. I mean, what always shocks me is just the sheer scale of that continent as well. I mean, you've got, I think, 53 countries in Africa.
Africa's huge.
Absolutely huge. And I think a lot of modern maps are... They're not always to scale. So the African, anything in the southern hemisphere is shrunk, and anything in the northern hemisphere, UK, Europe, North America is expanded. So if you look at a proper physical map, which is to scale, Africa is absolutely huge. And I just did this relatively small part of it.
Right. They say in most maps, because we stretch from the poles, so Greenland is not nearly as big as it looks on the map. But Africa, which sits right in the middle on the equator, is much bigger. I didn't realize until I had to fly across it. I'm like, wow, this is huge. So in terms of distances, I'm sure in all the other continents you've mapped it out, with lowest to highest. Which is the farthest distance?
So the real big one will be Asia, no doubt about it. And that is, you know, the high point is Everest, you know, which is in the Himalayas. Low point is Dead Sea, which is right there in the Middle East. So you've got to go all the way across Asia. So that's going to be about 4,500 miles through many countries, lots of tricky challenges, Iran. Geopolitically, Iran, Iraq. Actually, I just got my heads together with somebody to try and figure out the best route, because it's very complex in that region. The best route, it turns out, might involve getting on the water and doing some rowing to cut across all of the dodgy bits. So we'll see. We're working on it. I should mention, actually, earlier this year, which I don't think I've covered with you, but I did do the South America leg at the start of this year. So that was similar distance to Africa. That was 1,600 miles as well. Finished up on Aconcagua in the Andes.
Okay. So in the lowest, would that be like the salt flats in Bolivia or something? I don't know where the lowest point is.
Well, it's a good theory. It feels like it should be there. It's actually in Patagonia, right down in the south. So more on the Atlantic side. Everyone thinks of the mountains in Patagonia, but also on the Atlantic side in Argentina, you've got Patagonian desert and these sort of old historical lakes, which are below sea level. So that was the lowest point in this kind of ranching country. Felt like I could have been in Texas or something, and then cycle way up through Argentina up into the Andes, which are, you know, huge mountain chain. But you got the benefit there. Once we climb the mountain, ultimately you finish in Mendoza, which is a steak and wine capital of the continent.
Yeah,
it was the perfect place to finish the journey.
Well, so how long did that take? I didn't know you did this one. I thought you only done the two. I probably would have learned that if I had woken up at the proper time this morning. And that just kills me. You know, I was up. I was taking laps around the deck while you were up there talking. I was like, all right, maybe I'll go down there now. Idiot. So how long did the South America leg take? And when did you do that?
So I set off just after New Year. So I think it was about the 7th of January this year.
Okay.
So flew out to Argentina. That was 36 days from start to finish, about 18 days on the bike, but then about 18 days on the mountain, because although it's about 1,100 meters higher, or say 4,000 feet higher than Kili, but just that bit is where, you know, everything increases a lot. And by the time you're on the summit, it is brutally tough. You know, it's not a technical mountain, it's still a trek. It's kind of similar to Kili in that way. But the high camp is above the level of Kili's summit. Ooh. And you're staying up there for a few nights. Ouch. And then you've got to go another big summit day to get to the top. So it's a brutal, brutal mountain. Very low summit success ratio on the mountain as well. Very, very cold, very windy. But yeah, really cool, really spectacular, rugged.
Wow. Okay. Is Antarctica on this list? And is that even possible? A, it sounds very cold. And B, it sounds very expensive.
It's all of those things. Okay. It's just about possible, but yeah, you're right. It will mean working very hard to try and get some sponsors on board, which is always the biggest challenge of any of these expeditions, trying to get the support to make it happen. But yeah, it will involve a lot of skiing across the Antarctic continent, hauling a heavy sled, of course, freezing cold temperatures, complex logistics, and then ultimately finishing up on a mountain, which is Mount Vinson. Which is, it's not as high as Kili, but because of where it is, you know, freezing cold, you're up on a glacier, so you've got to be prepared for that. But yeah, that's part of the plan.
Oof. So back to South America, did you have a team there as well climbing the mountain?
Yes, so one of my Denali teammates joined me in South America. So it was just the two of us. So it was a very slick, lightweight team. Just being two, it means you need to carry a bit more. You can't split everything across four people. But yeah, he was a great teammate. He's super reliable, really fit. And it's a really sociable kind of mountain, actually, because in the lower camps, the weather is not quite as harsh. You can get out, you can meet other climbers. So there's a good climbing community there. And if you're lucky, you can find someone with a barbecue who's cooking some steaks, even on the mountain. So yeah, there's some perks to be had on that one.
So do you have a time frame on when you want to finish all these? And do you know what order you want to go in? Does the season... I guess determine that, or you want to save one for the end, like Everest for the end, or Europe? I don't know.
Yeah, it feels like saving Everest to the end feels like the right fit, because that's the big one.
Right.
At the moment, I've been doing one about every 8 or 9 months, and it's kind of that's needed, that planning time, because these projects take a long time to plan. So I'm looking at potentially Australasia next. Which would be hopefully a relatively easy one to tick off. That would then leave me with Europe, Asia, and Antarctica. The challenge with Europe right now is the low point and high point is actually in Russia. It's in the western part of Russia, which is categorized as Europe. So yeah, that's tricky right now. You know, I'm just going to wait and see what the situation is. Hopefully, you know, the situation improves and I can go out there more safely. And otherwise, I've got the two big ones of Antarctica and Everest. So yeah, if I can do one every sort of 6 to 9 months, I'll be quite happy. But it's a long project. It's a long-term project, and you know, it's going to take time.
What's the one in Australia? Where's that?
So Australia is an interesting one. It depends how you define the continent, ultimately.
Yeah.
If you define it as Oceania or Australasia, changes the challenge significantly, because Oceania includes West Papua.
Yeah,
it was
like Borneo or whatever.
Exactly, yeah. So that would involve basically, you know, rowing across the water where you got sharks and crocodiles, climbing through the jungle.
Headhunters.
So as much as that sounds like a great adventure, I've looked into this so much, and I just not 100% sure if it's feasible yet. So the Australasia version is essentially a big ride across the outback from pretty much right in the middle of Australia out towards Sydney and Melbourne. So it'll be very hot.
Blue Mountains or whatever.
Yeah, close to those. The mountain's not too hard. It's maybe 7,000 feet, something like that. So it's pretty straightforward. But yeah, going through the outback, I think, will be the challenging part.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you talk about lack of gas stations and anything. There's nothing out there. Nothing. Kangaroos. That's it. Look out for the kangaroos. So since you've started all this, you've since gotten married. You have two children?
Yes.
Two children who are with you right now, right?
They're in the UK.
Your wife's here.
Oh, yeah, my wife's here.
The kids are not.
Kids are not.
Okay, I was going to say, that was going to be a crowded cabin.
Yeah.
So you're getting all your sleep now.
Absolutely. This is the most sleep I've ever had in 5 years.
Yeah.
So yeah, I thank God for the grandparents this week who are helping us out.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
How old are the kids now?
They are 4 and 2. So yeah, and my daughter, ever since I climbed Denali, she welcomed me back from the airport, which is, you know, a really special moment. And the very first thing she said to me was, when can I climb a mountain with you?
Boy.
So this summer, we were, earlier this summer, a few months ago, we were out in Norway. And so we found this mountain, which we thought was just about doable. And so she climbed her first mountain on her own without any help. So that was a proud dad moment, definitely.
Right. If we took Russia out of the equation and just say, okay, we're not going to count them as part of Europe, what would the highest point be? Would it be in the Switzerland or something, the Alps? Is it the Matterhorn? I don't even know.
Close. It is Mont Blanc, actually. So
okay.
Mont Blanc in the French Alps. So
all
it's
right.
on the French-Italian border, just above beautiful town called Chamonix. So I have, which is stunning. And I have climbed Mont Blanc before, actually. But what I'd need to do is figure out the low point in sort of the other part of Russia, the other part of Europe. So yeah, I need to do some figuring out. I mean, it feels like that could be a good challenge in itself.
What would be the lowest? Would it be Holland? I don't even know.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, you've got what they call like the flat countries. Yeah, Holland
countries.
And Belgium. And so maybe it could be around there. But I need to go and do some research after this.
Yeah. What's the traditional? My mind immediately went to the Low Countries just because it's right in the name. So has there been a point where you're doing research and you have a plan on taking this trip? And has your wife, she knows what she was getting into when you guys got together. Has she ever put her foot down and gone, look, this is too dangerous?
Yeah, there's been some moments like that, definitely. I think that's why we've managed to have this relationship where I'm going doing these trips, is that I bring her into the decision-making as much as possible. And, you know, often she'll almost, like, cross-examine me, you know. I'll kind of lay out a plan and lay out the possible risks and things, and she'll ask, well, what if this happens, and do you have this piece of kit? And we'll go through it together, and I think that gives her peace of mind. And also, if I can't answer a question really well, I know, okay, maybe I need to go and have another look at this. So yeah, it for me, it's got to be kind of a joint thing. I can't just declare, right, I'm going off, you know, I don't care about the risks. No, I've got to stay on the right side of risks, definitely.
What about, let's get to the fun stuff, like the craziest flight you've ever had. What's the most memorable flight, good or bad, that you've ever had?
Oh, that's a tough one. One that was very memorable. I'd been in the Congo. This was a trip I did in 2017. So Congo is right in the heart of Africa. It's a very wild country. You've got volcanoes, you've got mountain gorillas, you've got jungles. You have got a lot of problems there, unfortunately, but very wild, very beautiful country. We'd just been there climbing this volcano, and we flew out from a town called Goma, and it's like no airport I've ever seen. It's this ramshackle kind of building. And you know, normally you put your bag on a conveyor when you're checking it in and off it goes down a hatch somewhere. This time they didn't have a conveyor. They just had about 10 guys chain ganging luggage, and they passed it and then they chucked out a hatch, and you just think, right, I'm never going to see that again. But when we took off from this airport, then we circled around this big volcano called Nyiragongo, which has got the world's biggest active lava lake in it, this huge lava lake. And so circled around that, you got jungle down there, smoking volcano. Yeah, I mean, I can still see it in my mind. It was incredible.
How about the craziest thing you ever ate?
Ooh, yeah, there's been a few. Actually, what set off that whole meningitis episode was, I suspect, potentially, just because it makes for a good story, but a camel burger in Somalia.
Oh, yeah.
I was eating a camel burger, and I very quickly got ill, seriously ill after that. So I wouldn't recommend camel burgers. I've had all kinds of weird meals. I remember being served up a bowl of testicles. I have no idea what kind of testicles. This was in Azerbaijan. And, you know, I got into this place with a local, and there was a real language barrier. And he said, oh, I'll order you something. I thought, oh, great, he's going to get me a nice local dish. And that's what I was served with. So I was just being, you know, and you got all the locals sort of sniggering. So I think he was stitching me up. But yeah, there's been a lot of strange meals over the years. I'm a bit ashamed to say this, but somebody served me some zebra. I mean, they're beautiful animals, but it did taste pretty good.
So the irony is, when you mentioned that you got sick from the camel burger, when you showed a photo of it at the at your talk, it looked pretty good, I gotta admit.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah,
it was pretty good.
It looks just like an amazing hamburger.
Yeah,
and things
like a pretty good burger to me.
But yeah, I paid the price for that one.
So is there a time limit where you think you're gonna you want all this finished by? And if so, what do you think the next challenge will be after you do that?
Yeah, so I think in the next 2 to 3 years, I want to get this project wrapped up. So I would say I'm about halfway there now. You know, it's still going to take a lot of time to make this happen. I think beyond that, what I'm really enjoying now is getting my kids into this world of adventure and mountain climbing. So I'm already thinking about family adventures. I've got this, I know this guy who's just taken a year out with his family, and he's gone and traveled to really wild places like Kyrgyzstan and Papua New Guinea and Northern Canada and things. And they've just had this year of adventure. For me, I think as you grow and your dreams evolve, that sounds really exciting. So it might be something like that, yeah.
Like a family risk adventure, I don't know.
Something like that.
Is your wife adventurous as you? I mean, does she go out there on the trail?
Absolutely. So yesterday we stopped in Ketchikan, Alaska. We climbed up Deer Mountain. We do a lot of travel together. We, you know, travel quite extensively. Maybe not the same level of risk that I'm willing to handle, but yeah, she's up for an adventure anytime.
And I'm sure everybody says, "Oh, all these stories, you got a book in you or something." Do you have one in the works or a film or something else you want to document all this?
Yes, so hopefully both. I'm working on a book right now, which, you know, hopefully will be out there in the wider world in the next year or two. I've just accumulated all these stories over the years, and now I want to try and get them down onto paper and share them. And the other thing is, with this project, which I've called the Ultimate Seven Project, of going from the low point to the high points, I'm working with a TV production company right now. So, again, all going well. I'll complete this journey successfully, and we'll be able to share it with the world one way or another. So watch this space, as they say.
Yeah. So speaking of that, where can people follow you on Instagram? And are you mostly focused on Instagram, or are you on other different ones?
So I'm most active on Instagram, and you'll find me at Oli_France, Oli_France. Pretty active on LinkedIn. I need to do a bit more on YouTube. I've got some of my expedition clips up there on YouTube. Come and find me. I'm pretty easy to find.
Yeah. And you got the blue check mark. So, I mean, we know it's you. What did I want to ask you? Oh, so after you're done with this, you can now be our UK travel guide really quick. For people who are outdoorsy and want to do hikes somewhere in the UK, where do you send them? Where do you think is great? Has like top level, just in terms of scenery, but not too hard, but you know, anybody can do it, but it's really good.
Oh, I love that question. And this has kind of been my training ground. You know, grew up in the UK. So I'm very lucky. I live an hour from a place called the Lake District in England. Oh, yeah. I would recommend that to anybody, no matter what your kind of fitness level is, how much you've got an appetite for climbing mountains, because you've got lots of mountains, you've got lots of lakes, you've got beautiful rivers, villages. It's very traditional. You just know that you're in England. You know, it's very like quintessential England. So I'd highly recommend that. It's very picturesque. If you want to go somewhere a bit more off grid and a bit more off the beaten path, I would tell people to go to the Isle of Skye off the north of Scotland.
I just went there last
year. Did you really? Yeah, what did you think? You like?
Oh, it was beautiful. It was beautiful. And because I was working, I caught a ship in Inverness, or Invergordon, I guess it was. But I had like 4 days off, so I rented a car and drove across. And it was really, really beautiful. And it was peak time of year. It was August, so it was a lot of tourists. But still, it never felt really super crowded until you went to the popular castles and stuff, and then busloads of people. But yeah, I would have loved to have more time to explore the countryside, though. It was great. Is there's good hikes up there?
Oh yeah, loads. If you get yourself up there, you know, my recommendation would be, go and see the touristy parts, the castles, and you've got something called the Old Man of Stour, these incredible rock pillars and glacial, old sort of glacial lakes and things like that, the fairy pools, exactly. But if you're feeling adventurous, you know, there are endless mountains there, and you can go and find a mountain to yourself on the Isle of Skye.
Oh, that's great. And finally, what do you think all this travel and all the places you've seen and what you've done, what has it taught you about people, about the world, about yourself? What have you learned from all this?
What I've learned about the world is that, and people in general, is that I think, unfortunately, and I've visited a lot of places which, you know, get bad press. They're seen as dangerous places. They're seen as hostile places. Having been there firsthand, spent, you know, years of my life in these places, 99% of people out there are good. Most people out there are just trying to raise a family, start a business, do their job, get on with each other. I've had, you know, incredible hospitality shown to me all around the world. I've shared meals and shared drinks with people from all cultures. You know, we're all just human beings with our own struggles and doubts and hardships. And I think travel has really shown me that, you know, we're far more similar than we are different as humans. And that's just something I try and take forward to everything I do.
That's great. Well, I appreciate you doing this. Congratulations on your accomplishments and everything else. And I will be following along on Instagram and social media and everything else. Thank you for doing this. Have a safe trip back. Oli France, everybody.
Thank you, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure. Really appreciate the conversation, and look forward to our adventures on the ship.
Yeah, let's go to the buffet, huh? For For spontaneous travelers, Winging It is the perfect listen. James Hammond shares stories and tips from 75-plus countries. Find it at voyescape.com.